From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Getting mandatory meal breaks was a hard-fought battle by labor many years ago. But what happens when workers decide to skip the break? Is the employer required to ensure a meal break is taken? A high-profile case that could resolve this question has made its way to the California Supreme Court. Justices are hearing arguments at this hour. The defendant in the case is Brinker Restaurant Corporation, which was sued by current and former employees. They said Brinker did not provide them with meal breaks. Joining us to discuss some of the issues in this is the president and CEO of the California Restaurant Association, Jot Condi. Welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Why is this issue of particular interest to the restaurant business?
Well, it's an interest to many businesses and business sectors in California. But for the restaurant industry, there is the question of, are they required to provide a meal period or ensure a meal period? And like you said in your intro, the restaurant industry takes a position that we think that we ought to be providing a meal period, not ensuring. The problem is that if an employee decides to work through their meal period, it puts the restaurant at a great risk of legal liability. And so restaurants now are being forced to enforce the policies of a restaurant. And if they're not taking a meal break, in a lot of cases, they're firing them.
Remind us what the law says at this time about meal breaks. What are the responsibilities of employers and employees?
It's complex. The law requires that if you are working a 5-hour shift, you have to have a 30-minute meal period.
Paid.
A 30-minute unpaid meal period. If you want to take an on-duty meal period, which is paid, you have to have a mutual agreement between the employee and the employer. But that only applies to industries where the nature of the work requires, disallows someone from taking a break because of, for instance, a 911 operator. You can't just walk out off the job and take a break. So you have to be in a certain kind of industry in order to get a non-duty meal period. So the laws are complex. They're unclear. That's the problem. I think what's going to happen today, hopefully, will there be some clarity. No matter how the court case comes down, we're looking for clarity because you have statutes, you have legal opinion letters from regulators, you have court cases, and they are all crashing into an intersection, and who's left in the middle are the employees and the employers who don't have clarity on the issue.
At this time, before this whole issue is resolved, what would happen if an employee said to his or her employer, I want to skip my meal break today?
The employer wouldn't allow the employee to do it. Because the employer, if he or she allowed the employee to skip the meal break, would then be potentially liable for a lawsuit.
Conversely, what if an employer said to an employee, we're too busy today, I need you to skip your meal break?
They can't do that. They're required to provide a meal break for employees if they're working a 5-hour shift. So the problem is for our industry, this affects different industries differently. In the restaurant industry, it's kind of a unique circumstance because the employees in many cases and the employers are on the same side. I think we've all been through an experience in a restaurant where a server who is serving our table comes to us midway through the meal with another server and says, I'm going on my break. Bob here is going to take over. In many cases, these servers don't want to go on a break because while they're gone on their 30-minute break, the table has turned over and the tip has been left for the replacement server. And so why it's so unique for our industry is that in many cases, the servers and the employers are on the same side here.
My guest is Jot Condi, president and CEO of the California Restaurant Association. We're talking about the issue of meal breaks in the workplace. There's a case being heard by the California Supreme Court at this hour involving the Brinker Restaurant Corporation. And Jot, the Brinker Restaurant Corporation owns some well-known businesses. What are they?
The one I think most people know of is Chili's and Maggiano's.
Now, as I understand, the original case in this involved current and former employees of the Brinker Restaurant Corporation. And what they said was that they weren't provided with meal breaks. How did that become the issue that seems to be at hand, which is what to do if the employees don't want to take their meal break?
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of the case when it first came about many years ago, but that's the question. Did the employer provide the meal break or did the employer ensure the meal break? And obviously, it's all the way in the Supreme Court, so there's differing opinions.
As I said, the Supreme Court is hearing this issue at this time, and Capital Public Radio reporter Ben Adler is monitoring the hearing via the internet. And he sent us a clip of one of the attorneys speaking to with the justices. This is San Francisco attorney Michael Rubin, who's representing the employees who sued Brinker.
As the declarations that the trial court was permitted to credit demonstrated, because there was understaffing during busy periods and no one could leave their table unattended, and because there was pressure not to give up tips, workers were pressured not to take the first or the second rest break during busy times. There's no need for us to show that every rest break was in fact missed. All we need to prove, and we can do this through surveys followed by validating depositions, is that as to those breaks that were missed, the reason was employer pressure rather than employee free choice.
That was attorney Michael Rubin speaking earlier this morning at the California Supreme Court. Jot Condi, he's saying that that in this case, and I guess by extension in other cases, that employers are, even if they're not directly forcing their employees to skip meal breaks, they might be suggesting that it would be a good idea.
Yeah, well, but they're required by law to provide that meal break, and there's obviously a complex body of laws that protect workers' rights in California, probably more protective than any other state in the union. But employers have to provide that. Now, they can't coerce them into not taking a break, and there's a body of law that protect them in that regard.
What is the California Restaurants Association's position on meal breaks? Do you support the requirement that employers should provide meal breaks?
We do. And I think that it's a reasonable law. Employees should have the opportunity to take a break. The question is, if you provide it for them, is that enough? In 2005, when the state of California, DLSE, the Department of Labor Standards Enforcement, was having hearings throughout the state, taking public comment about where industries are on this issue, I showed up in L.A., and typically when you have hearings like this, it's usually the employer pitted against the employee. There were probably 300 or more than 300 restaurant employees who showed up at that hearing to basically say, we're grown-ups, we're provided a meal period. If we're hungry, we will take a break. In fact, we are where the food is. And in many cases, we don't want to take a break. We'd rather not take a break, work through it, earn our tips, and maybe get off early.
But nevertheless, despite the fact that there are clearly many workers who want the ability to skip their meal breaks, and there are certain situations about the restaurant business that make it an unusual circumstance, clearly the law exists because there will be employers who put pressure overtly or covertly on their employees to skip their meal breaks. And so if the law isn't absolute on the matter, you then get gray areas, and that's where you can end up with exploitation.
Yeah, I think sort of the gray areas have created this lawsuit. We're the Supreme Court's meeting today on this. But what you have in the meantime, because the liabilities are so great for restaurants, is that you don't have, if employers are coercing employees not to take meal breaks, that's not right. But what's happening right now is that employers now are firing their employees who skip a meal break because they're afraid of the liabilities that exist potentially down the road. So it's actually having an opposite effect on the employee's welfare in the workplace.
The Supreme Court is hearing this issue today, but it's been about 3 years since they granted review in the case of Brinker. In this case, that means it's been unresolved and up in the air for years.
Mm-hmm.
What has that meant for restaurants and other businesses?
Well, that's it. In the meantime, while the industry, not just this industry, but many industries are waiting to see what happens here in this court case today, they're being very strict with how they apply this in the workplace, this meal and rest period policy. They will release employees if they don't take them. And they're being extra careful about it in the meantime. There's, of course, existing cases that are in abeyance right now, waiting for a resolution. So we hope that when a decision comes down, those existing cases will be resolved and employers and employees in the restaurant industry can, you know, get back to work, as it were.
You're not a lawyer, neither am I, but the appeals court sided with Brinker. What is the law at this point then? Is it is it in accordance with what the appeals court found, or does it revert to what the state law said right at the start?
Oh, I'm glad you said I'm not a lawyer, because I can't answer that. But I can tell you that case, the one before this Supreme Court case, the court held, or at least sort of referenced the fact that in the restaurant environment, if you have one manager who's trying to keep track of dozens and dozens of employees and making sure they're taking to ensure that they're taking their 30-minute break, it's pretty complex. And if you put a manager in that position to have to keep track of when everyone's taking their breaks, it's a pretty difficult environment to operate.
Clearly, a lot of people, a lot of businesses looking forward to this issue being resolved. It's a daily workplace issue. When do we expect a decision from the Supreme Court?
I believe 90 days is when we'll hear something from them.
Jack Conde, President and CEO of the California Restaurant Association, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ben Adler of Capital Public Radio. We'll have a story on today's California Supreme Court hearing later today during All Things Considered. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, an opposing view on one of yesterday's topics, the proposal by Goodwill to run the alternative sentencing program in Sacramento County. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us today with Insight Online is Insight senior producer Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. You just heard Jack Conde from the California Restaurant Association talking about the Brinker case being heard before the California Supreme Court today. The court is trying to decide whether employers need to simply allow employees to take rest and meal breaks, or whether they need to ensure employees take those breaks. Yesterday, we asked you to tell us what you think about it. Listener Joshua Hutchison wrote, "Just recently, enforcement has finally become effective with shade, water, and sanitation requirements for farm laborers. It required manslaughter charges against the employers. If such basic minimums, such as shade and water, are only universally given under the threat of jail time, then what would happen if breaks become voluntary? A race to the bottom. Market forces without any protection for the people involved do not create efficiencies." Let us know what you think about this topic or anything else you hear on the show by commenting on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio, or you can always send an email to insight@capradio.org.
Thanks, Jen.
You're very welcome.
Now, here's an opposing view on a topic we discussed yesterday. The nonprofit Goodwill Industries wants to run the alternative sentencing program in Sacramento County and use most of the money it receives to help the homeless. Goodwill says that could be as much as $250,000 a year. Homeless services offered by local governments have been greatly cut because of the economy. Well, after yesterday's show, I heard from the head of the group that currently runs the alternative sentencing program. Frank Kennedy, executive director of the Volunteer Center of Sacramento, questions things that were said yesterday on Insight, and he joins us. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me.
When you heard the CEO of Goodwill Industries on Insight yesterday, what was your reaction?
Well, they've come out and said that there would be an excess of $250,000 of operating they will have from the fees that collected by alternative sentencing program. And I've run the numbers. I have the figures in front of me that are available to people in the public. And their claim of that is just simply not true.
What would be a more realistic number in your opinion?
Well, I've used the year in question, the 2009-2010 year. They've taken the figure off of our 990 tax return, which is available on GuideStar. Anybody can go to GuideStar.org and look it up. And have run those numbers, and they failed to realize in that same year, out of the $903,000 we should have collected, there was about $189,000 of those fees we didn't collect. Because as you might imagine, people who are sentenced to the alternative sentencing program don't always complete. They don't always pay all their fees. So the operating expenses are, and the income they can generate from this program is, it's completely false. Then if you take their reduced fee schedule, because they have proposed to the court they're going to charge the alternative sentencing program clients even less than we do, in the particular year in question, they would have only raised $609,000, and it cost them, by their own admission and their proposal they put forward, that it would cost $677,000 to run the program for a year. So they'd be operating at a deficit, and their proposal is that not most of their money would go back into homeless, but 80% of their net profit. So if there's no net profit, there would be no money going back into the community. And so it's by the numbers that we have, their claim is literally impossible.
Well, you said that they would be running at a deficit in the current environment if they were to take over the program under the conditions that they're proposing, the Goodwill is proposing. What about the Volunteer Center of Sacramento? Are you running a deficit?
We are running a deficit. In the last 2 years, we've had a deficit of about $88,000, and we've allowed to stay in business because of the reserves we've built up over the last maybe 5 years before that.
Well, that's not sustainable, of course.
It's not sustainable, and we've actually lost a couple, or had to, through attrition, eliminate a couple positions trying to make ends meet. And so we are a struggling nonprofit, just like many other nonprofits out there in the community. And it's really our mission to go out and match people who want to volunteer or need to volunteer with opportunities to serve. You know, that's our mission, and that's what everything we do at the Volunteer Center revolves around, including the alternative sentencing program.
And when you say need to volunteer, we're talking in this particular case about people who've been sentenced to because of some offense they committed, and this is part of their paying off their debt to society.
Absolutely. About 85% of the people we see through our program right now are simply people who are traffic offenders who can't afford to pay a traffic fine. So they come to us and pay us a substantially less amount in a fee for service, and we find a place. We have about 250 different organizations in the community right now where they're approved to go out and perform community service. We place them, track them, and report back to the court on their success or failure.
And when you see traffic offenders, are we talking about people who've got DUIs, or are we talking about rolling stops?
These are just all traffic offenders. DUI is a criminal offense, and so they would come to us from the criminal court. And there are some people who are mandated to do community service, and that is basically a litter offense. If you are cited for littering, throwing something out of your car, you're sent to us with a mandatory 8 hours of trash pickup. So it's really a restorative justice model, which says you've somehow harmed the community, and now you got to go back in that same community and make it better.
We're hearing another take on a topic we discussed yesterday in Insight, the proposal by Goodwill Industries to run the alternative sentencing program in Sacramento County, and they say they'd be able to give a couple of $100,000 to benefit the homeless. Frank Kennedy is executive director of the Volunteer Center of Sacramento, which currently runs the alternative sentencing program. If the Volunteer Center has been running a deficit because of this in the last couple of years, why not just say to Goodwill, hey, have at it?
Well, it's what we do. It's 90% of our income. It's 90% of what we do. And if we lose the program, the Volunteer Center of Sacramento will close.
But aren't you at risk of that anyway if it's 90% of what you do and you've been running a deficit?
Well, at this point, we're able to modify our operations, trim some of the excess employees. Actually, the reason we're running at a deficit is because our referral numbers are lower than they were in previous years. With budget cuts, as an end user of the law enforcement and judicial system, our numbers have declined. When cops are cut on the street, when district attorneys are cut, when public defenders are cut, and court personnel is cut, they need to become much more efficient than they were in years past. And literally what that means is that the district attorney are not filing and charging people on minor offenses, and so they're not, our referrals are just not there. The district attorney's not filing on really minor crimes, and those are the crimes that used to be sent to the alternative sentencing program. So in about the last 18 months, we've seen a dynamic shift in the number of clients that were sent to us, and that's why we ran at a deficit in the last 2 years.
It's interesting how all these dominoes can continue falling way down the line and with unintended consequences.
That's a perfect example. As a domino in the criminal justice system, we are the last domino to fall. And in the first maybe 18 months of this really severe crisis we've had in society, we haven't had that fallout, but now it's hit us, and it's hit us pretty hard.
Did Goodwill Industries consult with the Volunteer Center of Sacramento when it was putting together its proposal?
Absolutely not.
When did you first hear about their proposal?
During a presentation to the Intermediates Punishment Committee in the court.
And was that because they sought you out and said, this is our idea, or did you just happen to hear it in the context of a meeting?
They gave a proposal and a presentation to the courts to take over the program.
And have you reached out to them since then or to their supporters, like Supervisor Phil Cerna, to say, hey, this is what we think?
We have not reached out to Supervisor Cerna. We've reached out to a number of the other Board of Supervisor members and got our side of the story. I was told through another media outlet who approached Supervisor Cerna, and he declined to talk to them about the issue at all.
Ultimately, the decision in this matter is made by judges. Is that correct?
That's my belief.
And have you talked to them? And what are they saying?
Well, they're a little confused by the whole situation. You know, they didn't ask for a presentation. They've been very happy with our service, but it brings up the question, I think, in their mind is who and what does this? Up until 2008, we actually had a contract with Sacramento County to run it. Even though the courts and the county are separate, we still had a contract with Sacramento County. But in 2008, when the budget crisis hit really hard, that was taken away. At that point, had to raise our fees in order to make up the difference in the money we weren't getting in our county contract. And since then, we've been operating at the leisure of the court and reporting directly back to the court, and the county's is out of our contract, and we don't have a contract at this point.
Have there been any reported problems with the way Volunteer Center of Sacramento has run the alternative sentencing program?
Not that I'm aware of.
The part of the Goodwill proposal was that they would be able to help the homeless if they were running the alternative sentencing program. Does the Volunteer Center of Sacramento offer anything to the homeless people now, or are you planning to in the future?
We have been for years. Currently, if you go to our website, we have 55 different opportunities for volunteers at homeless shelters, and we have 41 that are currently on our website to help feed the hungry. We also have, as placement opportunities through the alternative sentencing program, 35 different placement opportunities to help the homeless. We also run a wonderful program called Birthday Magic, which is a program that we run the Volunteer Center that does birthday parties for children in homeless shelters. So every month we're in four different shelters conducting birthday parties, even as large as the Mather Community Campus that has around 120 children in it, and they all do have a birthday party literally every month.
And just so people are clear here, although a lot of the volunteers, quote unquote, that you work with are there because they're paying off their debt to society, you do have people who are volunteering because they want to be a volunteer.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I said the alternative sentencing program is 90% of what we do. The other 10% of what we do is regular volunteer services and making those connections between people who want to volunteer and the opportunity to do so.
When do you think this will be resolved, this counter-proposal by Goodwill and the Volunteer Center of Sacramento's continuing interest to run the alternative sentencing program? Is there some deadline coming up?
There's no deadline that I'm aware of. It seems to me that the court and the judges are a little confused to even how to handle the matter. I'm hoping there'll be at least a short-term decision made in the very near future, and long-term we'll have to see what happens.
Frank Kennedy, Executive Director of the Volunteer Center of Sacramento, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, what's in the news in Davis? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? The man with the answer is Capital Public Radio's news editor, senior editor Alan Ray. He's in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. This is going to mean a lot more when we're at the end of the ski season than it will at the beginning, but California ski areas could see economic times improve in the non-traditional times of the year for ski areas. This would be the case for ski areas like Homewood and Heavenly that are in federal forest land. U.S. Forest Service ski areas can now operate year-round as recreation areas. That's expected. The change in policy would bring another 600 Forest Service employee jobs.
My goodness.
And, yeah, it could improve the businesses for recreational, people who do the off-season recreational sorts of things, zip lines, mountain bike terrain trails, that sort of thing. Even golf courses or, mini golf courses, that sort of thing. Cleanup is underway now in Citrus Heights after that huge fire yesterday afternoon at Sunrise Marketplace. It destroyed two buildings. Three alarms broke out just after 4 o'clock yesterday. The crews are there on the cleanup to do the cleanup outside right now, but they have to wait for a structural engineer to decide whether or not the building itself is safe to enter. You know, there's some stories that seem to come out of nowhere and get worse fast until they spiral completely out of control. This seems to be the case with a sex abuse scandal that's swirling around the legendary football program at Penn State University and its legendary coach Joe Paterno.
Oh yes, what a horror!
Now the problem is the real questions here are: what did Joe know? When did he know it? And why didn't he do more? He was supposed to hold a news conference today. He canceled it. Nobody's saying he was directly involved. A lot of people are saying he knew more and should have said more sooner.
Yeah, and should have done his press conference.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those stories coming up and more after, actually, at 3:30 this afternoon, all things considered on Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Each Tuesday, we tap into the Insight News Network to find out what's happening in one of our communities. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Hudson, who's a reporter for the Davis Enterprise newspaper, as well as covering the arts for Capital Public Radio. Jeff Hudson, welcome back to Insight.
Good to be here.
Well, we've got several pressing issues to discuss. The first, though, is water.
A couple months ago, the Davis City Council approved a plan to transition from the current water supply, which is well water that comes out of the ground, to a new water supply, which would be out of the Sacramento River, and it would go through a water treatment plant that would be shared with Woodland. Mm-hmm. This is a big, expensive project, and as part of the process, the water rates in Davis would double or triple. There's still some debate going on exactly what the numbers would be. Not everybody was pleased about this, and a petition was started, and some 5,000 signatures were gathered to put the issue before the voters. So now the Davis City Council has an interesting choice. They can either rescind the new water plan, or they can put it on the ballot in a special election, or they can put it on a ballot in a regularly scheduled election. But the petition needs about 3,500-some signatures in order to qualify. 5,000 were turned in, so assuming that most of those signatures are good, it's probably going to go somewhere.
Sounds like a pretty difficult thing to resolve, and water is one of those things that people expect to be delivered but don't care too much about the details, just don't charge me too much.
That is the case. Of course, with groundwater, if you've ever lived in Davis or used tap water in Davis, you know that the well water has a lot of mineral content. It's really hard. And one of the questions about this is that if the city were to stay with well water, and there are a lot of problems with that because the wells are old and the equipment needs replacing and so forth, the city would probably also have to build a fancy new water treatment plant because the water is so mineral laden out of the wells that it would need more processing. So some people are suggesting that this is kind of a you can pay me now or you can pay me later prospect, where you can either pay more and go on to the new water supply, or you can pay more, keep using the well water, and then spend the money on a water treatment plant to take care of it.
And as you mentioned at the start, this new water system will be shared by Davis and Woodland, but this initiative is in Davis only. But I guess Davis is limited in how it can act unilaterally in this matter without hurting Woodland.
Yeah, that's all getting sorted out, and who knows where it'll all go. I think this is one of the very few times I can remember the Woodland City Council and the Davis City Council ever doing anything jointly.
That's a good point. My guest is Jeff Hudson, reporter for the Davis Enterprise newspaper, also an arts critic and reporter for Capital Public Radio. Well, we've just been talking about a likely election in Davis, where they're very fond of elections.
Yes, it's sort of a participation sport, right up there with youth soccer.
So there's another election coming up.
The Davis School District voters have been approving local parcel tax measures to supplement the funding for local education. This goes back 30-plus years. The first one was passed right around 1980 after California voters, as you recall, approved Proposition 13 setting property tax limits in 1978. And so at that time, the Davis School District was financially strapped. They sold all their school buses. Davis does not own any school buses. Kids get to school on their bikes. It's kind of a compact town, so you can do that. And they were getting ready to sell the band instruments and the orchestra instruments and you know, do away with the music program, basically.
My goodness, Davis.
And, yeah, well, and so the local voters back in 1980 passed the first of these parcel tax measures to supplement the funding for local education. And they have renewed and upped the amount of the local parcel tax ever since. At this point, it's about $6.5 million a year from the measure that's up for renewal. It provides about 12% of the school district's payroll. It's a big chunk. You're not talking a teeny tiny supplement. It's a substantial supplement to the school district's budget, and it's going to be going before the voters in some form for a special vote-by-mail election on March the 6th.
But the people of Davis have stepped up several times to approve more funding for schools.
By a two-thirds margin.
Yes. But at a certain point, even the good folks of Davis are going to feel tapped out.
Well, indeed. This is as most of us are all too well aware, the economy has been through quite a few bumps and, you know, downturns and hits for several years now, and a lot of people in Davis are university employees who've had furlough days, or people who work in state government agencies, or who, you know, are public sector employees who have experienced a decline in their income as a result of state budget cutbacks. So anytime you're going out for a renewal of a local tax and you need a two-thirds majority to get there, you can't take it for granted in this day and age.
But I think it's also fair to say that there are a lot of people, families that moved to Davis first and foremost because of the school system.
As the saying goes, Jeffrey, nobody ever moved to Davis because of the beach or the beautiful mountain air. It's all about parks and schools, and that is why people do move there, yes.
We're talking about what's in the news in Davis right now, and my guest is Jeff Hudson, who reports among other organizations for the Davis Enterprise newspaper. They also love the books in Davis, but I guess not quite as much as they used to.
It's been a tough time for bookstores everywhere, and Davis is no exception. Bogey's Bookstore, which was downtown and was sort of a flagship bookstore, closed in 2008. And then, of course, the entire Borders chain, including the Davis Borders, went dark and had a liquidation sale over the summer. Now, another local bookstore, a used bookstore, independent bookstore called Sweetbriar Books, has announced that the past year has just been too much and the owner is going to close it down.
What does that leave?
There is still a Avid Reader bookstore, which handles new books. And then there's a very small bookshop called Logos Books that's run by a retired professor from the university who it's sort of his retirement project running this little used bookstore downtown. Mm. So there are still two left, but that's not a whole lot for a university town, really.
There is a UC Davis bookstore.
There is a very large UC Davis bookstore that carries all kinds of stuff, and that is certainly the biggest bookstore in town at this point.
Yeah, and when I sort of half jokingly said that maybe the people of Davis are less interested in books, of course we need to note that there are electronic ways to buy books nowadays, so you might still be reading just as many books, just not made of paper.
E-books are very big, and in fact my sister works for Barnes & Noble on their Nook product.
Oh.
Well, she doesn't live in Davis, though. She lives down in Silicon Valley. But there's also a very popular public library that is, try and find a seat in the public library in Davis. It's a full building.
You mentioned the closure of the Borders chain. Well, one of those Borders stores, as you said, was in Davis, and it was basically the anchor tenant in a very high-profile, very visible small strip mall at the gateway to the town. What's happening?
And I would even say that particular shopping center is well known because it has that big green lawn. We're talking about the Davis Commons Shopping Center, and it has about an acre of nice green lawn out in the front with suitable space that was designed by Mark Francis from the university landscape department. What used to be the Borders store in that shopping center has now been leased by Whole Foods, which is a natural and organic foods grocer, national outfit. And this has sent ripples through the community because Davis already has two Safeway stores, two Nugget Markets, the Davis Food Co-op, Trader Joe's, Grocery Outlet, Westlake Market, and about 13,000 square feet of groceries inside the Target store.
And this is a city with a population well below 100,000.
Oh, yeah, closer to 75,000. And as the saying goes, there's not a whole lot of unmet need for groceries in Davis at the moment. However, Whole Foods sees that location, and there is, of course, phenomenal amount of foot traffic that goes through there, and so they're planning to have a store. And the question is, okay, well, then what happens to the other stores?
Of course, Whole Foods is Whole Foods, so that shopping center in Davis seems to have landed on its feet.
I think that shopping center is a very prime location, and I've talked with Mark Friedman, who owns the shopping center, Fulcrum Properties owns it, and they had multiple people who were looking at that. That former Borders site was much sought after.
I'm sure there are plenty of owners of other shopping centers with empty Borders stores thinking, what do I need to do?
Well, I know that within Northern California, Whole Foods actually looked at all the former Borders locations.
Oh.
Yeah. They didn't take them all, but they looked at them all.
One more topic, and that is another institution in Davis, the Mondavi Center, part of which is wrapped up in plastic. Why is that?
Yeah, the whole south wall, part of the north wall, and part of the area around the box office. When the Mondavi Center was completed, it was built in 2001 and 2002.
That long ago.
We're coming up fast on the 10th anniversary, and having been there when the shovel went into the ground for the groundbreaking, I'm feeling that anniversary coming up in a particular way. There was less gray in my beard back then. During the construction of the Mondavi Center, apparently the waterproof membrane that was painted on over the building and then they put the sandstone tiles on the exterior, apparently that work wasn't done entirely right.
The thing about waterproof things is they need to be waterproof.
Indeed. And during periods of heavy rain and high winds, the Mondavi Center has had little drips and puddles that have come inside the building. So the university is going through and they've covered up large sections of the exterior of the building in white plastic. It actually looks like one of those wrapping sculpture projects that the artist Christo used to do. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the wrapped Reichstag building in Berlin, but they did that, and he's wrapped up sections of coastline and other things. This almost looks like one of Christo's projects.
Yeah, it's just a wonder that Don Roth at the Mondavi Center hasn't pretended that's what it really
is
about.
Well, I keep thinking they're going to find some way to take advantage of it. They are taking off 55,000 sandstone tiles from the exterior of the building and doing the waterproofing and then putting new sandstone tiles on that come from the same quarry in India that the original sandstone tiles came from. The project is going on for months and months. It was the product of a mediated settlement between UC Davis and the general contractor that built the Mondavi Center. The mediated agreement includes a confidentiality clause, and so no one is coming right out and saying exactly how much it all costs.
It's got to be a lot, though.
I would think so.
And a little embarrassing for at least some parties concerned.
I think that probably, in all likelihood, both parties want to get the job done, get the building fixed, and move on.
Yes, get rid of the plastic. Jeff Hudson, reporter for the Davis Enterprise newspaper, also an arts critic and reporter for Capital Public Radio, letting us know what's in the news in Davis. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how living doubled up, staying with family or friends makes it even harder for young people to get out of economic hardship. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Here's your weather. Sunny today, but crisp in the Central Valley. In Stockton, the high will reach 62. And there's an interesting sounding art exhibit in Stockton, posters of Soviet propaganda from the 70s and 80s. They cover a wide range of issues from drug abuse to world peace. The propaganda poster exhibit is at the San Joaquin County Administration Building in Stockton, runs through the end of December. Otherwise in weather, 61 today in Sacramento, 60 in Roseville, 50 in Nevada City, 64 in Modesto, 46 in Sparks, and 45 in South Lake Tahoe. There's a chance of rain in the weather forecast on Friday. When money is tight, everything gets harder, including finding a decent, stable place to live. So it's no wonder growing numbers of people double up. In other words, stay with family or friends. And while that can keep some people off the streets or out of shelters, it's not an ideal situation for anyone and can help make it harder for people to get out of economic hardship. Our guest to talk about doubling up and the price it exacts is Ronald Hallett, who's an assistant professor of education at University of the Pacific. He's author of the recent book, Educational Experiences of Hidden Homeless Teenagers Living Doubled Up. Ronald Hallett, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Isn't doubling up something people have done since the start of human beings?
It is. This idea of families living together and cross-cultural or cross-generational families living together where a grandparent can help take care of a grandchild is nothing new. What we're seeing, though, is a growth of families moving in together that are not related, or of families doing it not because they're choosing this arrangement, but because they have to.
And when does it become a problem? When does something that's a common part of being human become a problem?
Well, the problem, or what the federal government has kind of looked at as it being a problem, is when there's not enough space, when it's not an adequate space for these families to be living together. In some of the work that I was doing, we're looking at families that you have four different families living in a three-bedroom, and you have 16 or 17 people living in one space. And that becomes less adequate, especially when there's a lot of tension and mobility happening between the families.
Are those instances even legal?
The legality of it, as far as, like, is it legal to rent to someone?
Well,
in
to have
spaces?
That many people in a house, for example.
I don't know that it's illegal. It's not ideal.
Why is it not ideal? What are the prices that people pay for living that way?
Well, with the work that I was doing, I actually went into the study assuming that it was a bad situation, that if we had families living together because of economic crisis, that this was going to be detrimental to the students' education and to how they would be able to participate. And what I found is that wasn't necessarily the case. It was not ideal when there was a lot of tension between the two families, when they were trying to live side by side and it created conflict. And the problem there is that that meant there wasn't a lot of stability. If there was a conflict, both families would kind of end up separated and become homeless. And the families that would merge together and kind of work together as a team and maybe even form a new form of family, that was more ideal because they could delegate tasks, they could help out with their kids' education and make sure that everyone got to school on time and that there was someone there to help out with homework. So it's not a one kind of answer. It really depends on how the families form and work together.
You said make a new form of family. What do you mean?
Yeah. One of the families I worked with that fascinated me, this is where my interest in understanding how this could work, were these two women that had between them five kids, and they were both single parents. And they, one had lived in a shelter before and one had lived in a single space where it was like a studio apartment with her three kids. And they worked together and got this three-bedroom apartment where the kids shared one room and each woman had their own. And one woman worked two jobs to pay the lion's share of the bills, and the other woman, who was collecting welfare and trying to do a welfare work program, she made sure all the kids got to school on time, picked them all up from school, and then had homework time with them. And in that, they were kind of forming a new form of family, even though there was no romantic relationship between the two of them. It was really for their kids and their own stability that they were doing this.
We're talking about doubling up, a more common living situation for people, especially in this economy. My guest is someone who is studying this. He's Ronald Hallett, assistant professor of education at University of the Pacific. His new book is Educational Experiences of Hidden Homeless Teenagers, Living Doubled Up. There was just not too long ago, a census. Do we know how many people are living doubled up, and has the rate or the number increased?
It has increased. Unfortunately, the economic downturn has really increased the number of people that are making, I don't know if it's a choice, but are making these decisions. Between 2008 and 2009, the number went up from a little over 5 million to 6 million. So it was a really rapid increase even within that year.
It was a 20% increase.
Absolutely. So it is growing. And what we found is that my work was done mostly in low-income areas, but through anecdotal discussions with school districts and middle-class communities, they're finding that this choice is being made as well, as families are trying to stay in middle-class communities and stay at schools that they want their kids to maintain enrollment at, that they might make these decisions, and it's not just a low-income issue.
Is it harder to get out of doubling up once you are doubled up?
It is. What we find is that the federal government has two different ways of classifying this group. From an education perspective, they fall into the classification of homeless. However, HUD doesn't consider them homeless because they're trying to deal with... Yes, they have a home and they have finite resources as far as providing housing for all the people they already have. But this group is really a gray area between housed and homeless. We find that families, as they hit economic crisis, this is the first step before they end up at a shelter. They kind of use up all of their resources, their familial and friend resources.
Couch surfers.
Exactly. So they stay with a family, and then when something happens, they end up out on the street or making another choice. So it's kind of the first step out as well as into homelessness.
And does that explain the wording of the title of your book, Hidden Homeless Teenagers? In other words, they are, in a sense, homeless, but they're not perceived as being so.
Exactly. They don't even necessarily perceive themselves as homeless. None of the families that I would have that I worked with would have said that they were homeless, even though the districts, the school districts, are supposed to provide services for anyone identified as homeless under the McKinney-Vento Act. But none of these students or families would have known that they were. And even if I suggested that this was a possibility, there's so much shame associated with the term homeless that they really would deny and kind of reject that term.
How did the people you met, observed, how did they feel about the situation, especially when they were talking with you about it? Did they think this was an acceptable solution to the situation, or did they feel bad about it in some way?
It really kind of ran the gamut. Some of the families, this was all they knew, some of the teenagers, so that it was like a fish seeing water. They'd lived in that situation their whole life. In the communities, it wasn't like they were the only family living doubled up. And then other families, it was more of a shameful thing where they didn't necessarily want to discuss it. One family in particular had been in a middle-class community before and slowly had lost stability and ended up living in Watts. And the kids even had memories of living in a different space. So they felt more shame. But the families had lived in that situation their whole lives. It was what it was.
You're an assistant professor of education, but here mm-hmm. we're really talking about people's living situations. How does a person's living situation interact with their education?
Well, what I found with this group is that the families that really merged together and assigned tasks as far as education goes of who is going to be responsible for the kids and who is going to be responsible for education, those kids participated in the educational process. The ones that were trying to live side by side, there was so much conflict and so much struggle just to get through the day that it was harder to focus as much time and energy on education. Now, I don't want to suggest that one is an ideal situation, that we don't need to think about finding stable housing for all of these families. But until we do that, I think we need to think about how to support these families and make the environment as protective as possible for their kids.
It's a huge question and probably well beyond the scope of your expertise, but right. What needs to be done?
The big answer is that we need to think about affordable housing for families and think about job training and even how to boost the economy, because we can do all the job training we want. If there's no jobs out there,
yeah,
it doesn't do much, right? But given what we currently have, I think we need to really work with families and even educate ourselves, those that are working in a social welfare positions, about how to support these families and think about, this might be a better situation than where they'd lived before, so let's protect it. If they'd lived in a homeless shelter before or in someone's basement or a storage unit, this might be a better situation. So instead of just assuming it's bad, find ways to support these families and support their kids. The other part of it is we have programs out there that are homeless support programs, even in schools, where you can get these services if you identify as homeless. But these families, as well as work I've done in the past with other categories of homelessness, the students really reject those terms. So if you have a homeless support program, you're going to be the only one there. So finding other ways to really get this information out and provide these services.
Ronald Hallett is Assistant Professor of Education at University of the Pacific, and he's been studying the phenomenon of doubling up, and his new book is titled Educational Experiences of Hidden Homeless Teenagers Living Doubled Up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Insight. You've been listening to Insight. We will be back tomorrow. I'm Jeffrey Callison, today's associate producer and engineer, Lynn Weaver. The assistant producer of Insight is James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. There have been several initiatives on the ballot over the past 40 years trying to establish capital punishment or expand it. But next year's election may be the first time California voters will have the chance to vote on an initiative to abolish the death penalty. On the next Insight, we'll talk to the leader of a signature drive to get this on the 2012 ballot. Also, we'll talk with Carmichael pianist Kevin Sun, who'll soon be on NPR's From the Top. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.